Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. A little bit of news, since the last episode, I've actually managed to finish three books in that time, or two books and most of another book. I guess there's one book I'm reading is sort of like two books combined into one, which I'll talk about in a few episodes time. The reason I sort of put off one of the reviews a bit is because I've been traveling, and I'm currently in Hawaii on the island of, I'm probably getting the pronunciation here right, Kauai, in a place called Nawiliwili, and it's been really good fun. It was a long trip out here to Hawaii where I'm joining a cruise ship. It was 29 hours traveling plus an 11-hour time difference. So I actually got up at 5 o'clock to catch my plane, and then once I got to Hawaii, I went out with friends drinking and got to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning. So it turned out to be like a 34-hour day in total. I did sleep a bit on the plane coming over, and I read quite a lot on the plane coming over. That's how I managed to finish off most of two novels in that way. What else? Just went around Honolulu yesterday and other places. And this morning I went on a helicopter ride because where we are now on this island, is where a lot of the stuff, a lot of the helicopter sequences and scenery from the movie Jurassic Park was filmed. And I'm here for only one day in this place. And I thought, if I don't get on a helicopter and fly to the places where they flew in Jurassic Park, I'm going to be kicking myself. The way that I always look at this is because often I turn up somewhere for one day and I think, maybe I'll never come back here in my life. What will be the one thing that I'll regret not doing the most if I don't do it? And so then I just pay for it and do it. So I only vomited once on this flight, but it was more like Jurassic Park than I've ever seen. And that's, of course, sort of like a long-time favourite movie of mine. I think came out in, 93? Don't know. Long time ago, maybe 92. But it was great to see those places from the air and fly around. And didn't actually see any dinosaurs, but it looked as though I might have seen some dinosaurs. And lots of other movies filmed around here, like Indiana Jones, him running away from the Indians across a meadow at the very beginning of Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I saw that place from the air. It's not far away from where the ship is parked now. Anyway, so a fantastic, fantastic trip. Now I've got 5 sea days. So hopefully in these 5 sea days, I can get a big chunk of my National Novel Writing Month novel out of the way. But we'll see how that goes as well. So anyway, that's a bit of what I'm doing. Let's get on to today's book. Today's book is by Verna Vinge. He wrote a new novel that's just come out called Children of the Sky, and it's a follow-up to this book that I'm going to review today. And I started listening to that as an audiobook, and I thought, hey, wait a second, this is going to be the perfect excuse for me to reread one of my favourite novels, science fiction novels of all time, A Fire Upon the Deep, by Verna Vinge. And so I did. I downloaded it from Audible and listened to it. It's around about, it says here on Goodreads.com, 613 pages, first published in 1992, about the same time as Jurassic Park. Anyway, I've read it twice before, and when people ask me, hey, what's your top 5 science fiction novels of all time, it's very difficult to say that because, you know, they change all the time. Like, if I read a book now and review it, maybe it won't get a high score because I've read it a few times before, and it's not gonna like blow me away like it once did. And other novels I read for the first time and they're not so good, and then I read them a second or third time, and the third time or fourth time I read a book, it just gets better and better, and it goes up in my estimation. But when people say, what's your top 5 novels, I try and select 5 novels which I really enjoy, which are good recommendations to sort of show people what is possible with science fiction. And A Fire Upon the Deep and A Deepness in the Sky, A Fire Upon the Deep is the novel that I would recommend to people. And of course there's A Deepness in the Sky, which is a sort of like a prequel kind of novel, but it's a completely standalone story, but just set in the same universe, set in the same world as A Fire Upon the Deep. So this is a good reason. I read it at least twice before as a paperback, maybe 3 times, but I know definitely twice before. And so now here's an audiobook version of it, so I could get through it pretty quickly. So let me have a look at some notes that I made here. Oh, no, actually, what? Let's just go straight through it. So this, the world that this is set in is the galaxy. And there's something very important about this galaxy is that it has this thing called zones of thought. And this is one of the genius creations of Werner Vinge, because when you're talking about sort of like post-singularity or singularity kind of situations or stories, it's really difficult to make that meaningful on a personal level, on a human level, that we, us humans who are reading the novel, can understand what's going on. So there's like a novel that I think I reviewed for this podcast called Singularity Sky, by let's say Charles Stross, I'm guessing, and it was and also his Accelerando. It's like it's very difficult to say, okay, well, here we have, you know, this kind of technology, singularity technology, but then if a singularity can just do anything, sort of like a singularity technological construct can modify itself and do whatever it's want and manipulate energy in any way, it's like, well, what are humans going to do in that situation? Why do humans need to worry about what they're worrying about, you know? And and in the Singularity Sky, there was a very clever sort of device that was used there to sort of like break apart the different levels of technology, what actually happened. Well, I'm not going to go into it now, but there was one device there where sort of humanity was cast out throughout space in this weird time travel kind of thing, and the further you were from Earth, the higher technology got, because the people who were out there had sort of been there longer. It's a bit strange to explain it, but as sort of people set off from Earth and went further and further out, they found higher and higher levels of technology as they went out. Now, what Werner Vinge does here in A Deepness in the Sky is he creates this sort of new rule to the galaxy, which is where created sort of following the lines of mass distribution throughout the galaxy, that kind of sort of like where there's higher mass in the galaxy, sort of towards the center of the galaxy, there is different levels of thought compared to where there is less mass around the edges of the galaxy. And it's sort of like flipped, because normally, and this is actually mentioned in the novel, normally you'd think that the more intelligent species, the higher technology will be down in the center of the galaxy, where there's a lot of energy and there's a lot of black holes that they can use for power and to twist time and space by, all of the stuff that's down there. But here he's flipped it around. So in fact, down at the center of the galaxy is what's called the unthinking depths. Technology can't work down there. Humans can't think down there. Nothing can go on there. There's nothing with any kind of complexity. And then you've got the slow zone, which is there is a speed limit, which is the speed of light. And then above the slow dome, you've got I can't remember what the names of all these different zones are called, but you've got the beyond, the upper beyond, and the lower beyond, and the higher beyond, where you can go faster than light, and you can communicate instantaneously over long distances, although it does take a lot of effort. But when you get to the transcend, you get to the point where, like, singularity level technology can exist. And then beyond them, in the spaces between the galaxy, that's where the minds and the powers and these godlike beings evolve and just live out their lives and things like that. So now we can play, or this is what Werner Vinge does, he plays with the interaction between the different levels of technology and different levels of alien society and human society and all these different kinds of stuff without breaking the rules. So what happens is that there isn't really much free space in the beyond where you can travel faster than light and communicate and stuff like that for evolution to happen without being interrupted by visitors from other star systems, because it's very easy to get from one star system to the other. So evolution can't happen up there. Technological evolution doesn't, scientific evolution and revolutions happen, but it's very difficult for species to evolve. So down in the slow zone, where it's very difficult to get from one place to another, that's where star systems and planets are left alone for long enough that new intelligent life can evolve. And then when they sort of get star travel and they spread out and they get through into the beyond where you can go faster than light, then they can spread out and work their way up through the zones of thought and finally sort of start tinkering with their own transcendence in what's called the lower transcend or the high beyond, and that's what they can do. So what I've just said there is very, very quick explanation of one of the main principles, one of the main rules that have been changed or introduced into this galaxy here in A Fire Upon the Deep. And it sounds quite impressive, but like I say, it's great. You can it makes sense in fiction. I don't think it makes sense in the scientific principle, but it makes for a very good exploration of what thought is, what technology is, what communication means, and all that kind of stuff. So I'll just skip forward a bit to the technology section. Like, you can get anti-gravitational material, agrav, I think they call it, but that can only be manufactured in the very high beyond or in the transcend. So what they have to do, then it works in any one of the zones of thought, so even down right down into the unthinking depths, it will work, but it can only be manufactured up at the top. So it almost becomes it becomes more and more expensive as you bring it down, as you bring it down through the zones of thought. And that happens all the time. Like, computer programs run really, really well up in the transcend, and as you bring them further and further down, it gets less interesting, or, well, not less interesting, less intelligent, and more interesting in a way, because then you have to rely on human ingenuity, and humans have to control things, or, well, not humans, or any kind of alien mind has to control things as they go further and further down. It's good, because another thing which is amazing about the technology here is that it hasn't dated at all. Normally, when you're talking about high technology, and this happens quite a lot when I've noticed with these sort of very near future kind of cyberpunk stuff, you read it and you think, oh, well, technology just doesn't work like that anymore. Oh, it's not like that. It can't work like that. But what happens in this novel is, like I say, it's genius, because you can just say, well, Earth is in the slow zone, so we know that for our technology now on Earth, we can't go faster than light, we can't communicate faster than light, and all these different rules exist. However, we can just think, well, but it's good, because our computers, as they get better, we can just sort of like reposition Earth a little bit closer to the edge of the slow zone, or, to put it another way, we can draw the slow zone boundary between the slow zone and the beyond, and the lower beyond. We can just move it closer and closer to Earth as technology on Earth catches up with what is made in the book. And I think that's a very clever thing. So it doesn't matter that you go, oh, well, faster than light travel isn't possible. Yeah, but it's not possible here, but somewhere else it is. Oh, this isn't possible. Yeah, but it's not possible here, but it is elsewhere. And this rule exists in science. Oh, well, it exists here now, but, you know, in another zone, it doesn't have to. Another thing about this is that technology is very, very expensive, even up in the higher beyond in the transcend and stuff like that. It's it costs a lot to communicate with each other, so everything happens at very low bandwidth, because bandwidth is, it's tricky, because at the top there can be a lot of bandwidth, but then down below there isn't, and there's some technologies which will work in one place and won't work other places. So all communication happens by sort of text files, rather like emails, and very much newsgroup kind of stuff going on, rather than there is talk about the different kinds of technology, but bandwidth is such an issue. So it seems very much like that it's all, like you say, newsgroups and emails and text messages, very much like the internet was in around about 1992 when this came out, which is, again, that sort of feels a bit dated, but there is a reason why it's that. And people are going, oh yeah, I'm trying to talk to you, but, you know, we've been cut off, and I can't afford to download that much information, let me do it. And part of the story takes place with a company which routes traffic, which routes communications traffic around, and you can see that is a very, 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 very lucrative business to be in if you want to send information around the galaxy. It costs a lot. So that's, it's sort of, as I said, the grav material and things from the transcend are what creates value, and then communication is the thing that is expensive to do. So let me get onto a bit of the story here. Let me just say, I've said a little bit about the world. Werner Vinge is a genius. He has more clever ideas about technology and about the interaction of technology and intelligence and the different levels of technology. Like, I can't express enough how clever he is and how many cool ideas are in this novel. It's going to be to the point where, like, when I reviewed Terminal World, I said, oh, there's this thing, and it's like the zones of thought, which happens in this book. It's like almost the zones of thoughts and the mindset of the aliens and the different technologies that Werner Vinge talks about in this A Fire Upon the Deep has become just part of science fiction lingo, science fiction culture. In the same way that, say, I think it was Ursula K. Le Guin had the Ansible. Now, if you want to say, oh, faster than light communication, you can just say Ansible. And if you just say, oh, what zone of thought are you in? It almost means, okay, what level of technology is allowable in your universe? And things. Maybe that's not true, but I have sort of, it's a very clever way of thinking about the different science fiction novels as well, which is can all be encompassed, like almost any science fiction novel could be told in one of the zones that has been created here with the zones of thought. So the story is a bit like this. Humans get their way to the top of the beyond, the high beyond, and they cross over slightly into the transcend, and they find this old archive. I'm talking about everything that happens within like the prologue or the first chapter here, so I'm really not giving anything away. But they find this library which is full of recipes, and they say, okay, if you follow these instructions, you'll be able to create something which is quite useful to you. It'll be able to share the information in the library and give you a lot of power and things like that. So they start going through these recipes and start making this thing, and it gets out of control. And this happens on page 2 or 3 or something like that. So some humans escape and they take lots of children. This couple get all the children together and escape in this spaceship. And they also take with it some kind of artifact, which is part of the library, which is needed to either complete or control. They're not quite sure what it's for, but it's the last thing that is needed to control this power that is getting out of control. So this power does get out of control, and it's called the Blight, and it starts wrecking the upper zones, the upper areas, the outer areas of the galaxy. And the escape ship lands on a planet just above the slow zone. So it travels all the way through the beyond and lands on the slow zone. So the surviving members of the crew, which include 2 children, they have to survive until someone comes to pick them up. But they've been sending out a signal to the rest of the galaxy saying, hey, we're down here. And the reason why they've gone all the way down to the slow zone, or almost to the slow zone, is because that's the only place where the power can't reach them. There's no way for one of the powers, one of the singularity kind of transcended runaway technology powers, can get down to the bottom of the beyond, because they don't work down there. Their computers that can run one of these powers can't reach down into the lower zone, so they've gone where they think they're safe. The 2 children, the surviving members of their crew, they have to survive down on this planet until someone picks them up. And meanwhile, 4 characters get this message. And so two humans and 2 aliens called the Scrode Riders sort of head down into the zones, through the zones to find this ship, because they need the MacGuffin that is on the ship to help against the Blight. And throughout the book, we switch between these two stories. Now, on the planet, we have lots of fun with the aliens. I'll talk about the aliens a bit later. And there are 2 nations, these 2 sort of natives on this planet. There's sort of 2 nations at war, and each of these nations ends up with 1 child and 1 kind of set of resources, which helps them use the sort of alien, the human, and the sort of like the upper level technologies to make better weapons. And the kids don't know that the other kid is alive, so they both think they're the only human on the planet, and they're both helping their nation to defeat the other nation. So we've got this really cool sort of like two nations, 2 children divided against each other. There's a spaceship there, but it seems to be that in some ways the question of who controls the spaceship is important. It's very important to the story, but it doesn't seem that important to the kids down on Earth, because it is important to them in a way that, you know, that's what the 2 nations end up fighting about. These 2 nations of the natives down there end up fighting about to control the planet, but they don't realize how important. They're not controlling the planet, they're controlling the spaceship, but they don't realize how important the spaceship and the MacGuffin that is on the spaceship really is. So what really matters in this story is the spaceship, which is coming down through the zones to get to the to get the MacGuffin. This spaceship is called the Out of Band. And the Out of Band is interesting in a way, but it isn't as engaging as the Planetside story, because it's just a long chase sequence. You know, they're heading down and they're being chased by, you know, the other powers and other people trying to stop them, and everything's happening on this one ship. But it's quite a slow chase, and the stakes are very high, which, you know, because if they don't succeed, the whole galaxy is going to be destroyed. All the upper parts of the galaxy is going to be destroyed. And because humans are being blamed for releasing the blight against the galaxy, that, you know, human stars, systems are being destroyed, and whole civilizations are being destroyed as well, either by the blight or the enemies of the humans. And the destruction is impressive. You know, we see one big bit of a destruction. It's very, you know, it's very dramatic. It's you know, the humans are right there. They're in peril. And it's really cool. But I wanted more of that destruction. I wanted more to happen on the ship on the way down. And there is, of course, a few things that happen on the way. I don't want to give them too much away. I think what happens is that Vernor Vinge really likes talking about the Tynes, which are the aliens down on the planet. And he puts most effort into those characters and into that storyline, into those themes. And while the two storylines needed each other thematically and needed each other plot-wise, in the end, the story is very simple. It's set up at the very beginning of the first chapter. Hey, there's this MacGuffin. Let's go get it. And everything happens along the way is incidental to, like, this chase sequence. But the incidental stuff that happens along the way, I'd say, is amazing. Vernor Vinge says a lot in this novel about, like, say, technology and the mind. I'll get into some of that later. So, the characters. So we've got the two kids down on the planet. One's called Jeffrey, who is very cute and very innocent, a bit too innocent in a way. He seems to be very intelligent, and he does a lot of, like, interaction between him and the aliens, but it's a bit strange because we don't really know how alien the aliens are, and he seems a bit too innocent, a bit too naive in some ways, but maybe it's just because he's, what, 8 years old? No, I can't remember how old he's meant to be as well. And then you got his sister, Joanna. She's more spirited. I really much preferred her chapters. But then her character, her human character, was always overshadowed by the Tynes, the aliens, the natives on the planet, let me say, who she's interacting with. And then we've got, on the Out of Bound, the spaceship which is coming down through the zones, you've got Ravna, and she's like, whatever. I'm really not quite sure what she's doing in this novel. Of course, we do need her character, but she's just not very interesting at all. And never really felt any emotional connection with her. We just didn't really dwell on her enough. One thing I noticed in this read-through is she doesn't have any faults. She's good at what she does. She's clever, and she does the right thing in most situations. And sometimes she makes mistakes, but it's not her fault. And she's just a bit too competent, and she's a bit cold. And she, you know, it gets to the point where, like, a whole star system of humans has been wiped out, let's say that. And she, like, when she learns of the deaths of billions or trillions of people, she's, like, upset a bit for a minute. And then she, like, on the next page, she's just, like, getting on with stuff. And she never really seems to be affected by the events of the story around her. She's just, like, quite competently getting on with her role in the novel. And she's very unsatisfying to read. And then there's actually some other humans and other aliens that we find out sort of they get the same bit of news, sort of like that home system is destroyed, and it makes them do stupid things and seek revenge and just give up or do something. But Ravna, like, she, you know, she's just boring. She doesn't have the passion that some of the other characters in this novel does, and it's a pity because we spend a lot of time with her. The other human on the ship is called Pham Nguyen, and he is much more interested to talk about and to read about, because he has a lot of conflicts. He's got a lot of weaknesses. We're never quite sure, and he's never quite sure if he's a real person or not. Again, we find out very close and very near the beginning of that book that that a power has come in, a power called the Old One, and he's old because he's about 10 years old, which the book will explain why he's called the Old One when he's only 10 years old. He's sort of been reconstructed out of different body parts, and he's really unsure that his identity is real. He doesn't know if he's a real human person or not, or if he's just an artifact of the power. And he knows he's an artifact of the power in some ways, but in another ways, he's really not quite sure if his memories are his real memories. It's interesting. And his story is very interesting as well, because he was discovered by he actually lived on a medieval kind of world, which was discovered by a starfaring nation, which came in and, you know, found them there, and then he went away, and he sort of worked his way up through the zones in his backstory, and now he's working his way back down through the zones, back down to a medieval planet where these you know, where the MacGuffin is and the two kids are. So that's a quite interesting thing, how we trace him up and then back down through them as well. And there's these plants called the Scrode Riders. These were good fun. And again, it's Vinge's exploration into the nature of intelligence and nature of memory. Again, I could try and explain it here, but what you really need to do is just read this book, because it's more difficult for me. So let's get on to the natives of this planet. I can't remember what the planet's name is called, but these are called the Tynes, or that's what the humans start calling these animals. I say animals because they're made up, these aliens are made up out of animals. They're like these dog kind of things with long necks, and rat-like heads. And each one of the individual aliens is made up by 4, 5, 6, 7 individual dog-like creatures. And they communicate with each other. That, like, not, it's not telepathy. They use these different sounds, but they have these pads on their heads and their shoulders, which emit, like, say, like as like loudspeakers, but very, very high frequency loudspeakers. And they can transmit their thoughts between the different packs, the different members of each individual pack, and then that makes up a single alien Tyne identity. And and the way it works is that when one of their members dies, they can adopt another member, or they can sort of have sex and create a new member in that way, and then bring them up. So these different intelligences are made up of different elements, which they can mix and match, or that other people can mix and match for them. You get this sort of like pack, these people who are experts in putting packs together to create identities, to create new people. And again, I would explain this, but the vast majority of this book is an exploration. Oh, well, I say the vast majority. The vast majority of all of the stuff that's taking place on the planet, you know, in this one half of this storyline, one storyline in this book, is talking about the Tynes and the way that they interact with each other. And it's more than I can explain now. But just to get a bit into the characters of these things, what I found very interesting is the names of these different characters. They can actually use, they can, each one of their members has a name. So there was this one guy called Pilgrim, but he was actually called Rick Rackrum, because the three main members, which constituted the core of his personality, were called Rick and Rack and Rum, and then one of them dies and he gets another one who's called Scar, so then he becomes Pilgrim Rick Rack Scar. And there's other ones which have longer names, like Jamradamathan and Flonky Donkey Donk, which are sort of like things, like their names made up from the different things. But then that's just the different parts of their personality are made up for different elements of these dog-like beings. And then they have a name which they either select themselves or they're given this name. And Pilgrim is called Pilgrim because his mindset is one of a pilgrim. He likes traveling. He's very curious. He can sort of fit into different situations very cleverly. And he's always doing interesting stuff. And that's why he's called the Pilgrim, because and his memories go back many, many years through many, many different pack members over hundreds of years. And there's Woodcarver as well. And Woodcarver is a leader, and he slash she, because, you know, you can change your gender, your self-identified gender as you go through. Woodcarver has memories going back 600 years, because that pack has always bred within itself, so it's incest for 600 years, or, you know, many, many generations, but the incest is the only way to keep your soul pure. And Woodcarver comes from sort of like the idea of, like, you know, being very very careful of, like, stripping away of this and that. And then you've got Flenser, which again is another, you can sort of almost work out what the personality of Flenser is going to be straight away. And then there's Lord Steel, and you may think, oh man, this is really dumb, everyone's just a stereotype. And you've got Scriber and mendacious, or is it vendacious and salacious and scurrilous? And they call themselves these names because that's what they want to be identified as. And it's not just that they're stereotypes or archetypes, it's that that is what they do. They, you know, Woodcarver created Flenser and created vendacious, and they say, okay, we need someone who is going to be a trader. We need someone who's going to be very good at bargaining. Let's make someone called mendacious or vendacious. I can't remember the name of this. Who is very good at lying to people and say, oh, to get the upper hand on people, they need to be able to lie. And of course, this can backfire in different ways. And I want to make someone who's a best scientist ever. I'm going to make them really clinical and not worry about what they're doing. And they're going to be able to sort of make different packs and stuff. So Flenser comes along there. And then Flenser goes, oh, well, I'm going to make someone who doesn't have any, you know, I'm going to experiment with different personalities. And I'm going to experiment with someone who doesn't have any concept of empathy or love. And it's even more than me. So that's why he makes someone called Lord Steel. So it's a bit strange, like these you know, you got, okay, it's going to be it's Steel, and you think, oh, Lord Steel, it's such a stupid name, but it actually works in this way. Things as well. I'm sure there's lots of different things going in here about the, you know, ideas of thoughts and stuff like that. Ravna is one of the main characters, and there's lots of other names like Ramathamathan or something, which sounds a bit Buddhist. I don't know enough about that to pick it out, but that's something I noticed in the previous reading of this book, and then I was trying to pick it out. I just don't know enough about that kind of stuff. I need to get on and finish Lord of Light, which is a book I've not finished. I've read half, listened to half of it, and then picked it up as a paper book. But I need to get through more of that and to maybe understand a bit more of the what's coming out of this book through that one there as well. We, like I say, a lot of information in the book is about how these packs interact and then how they make scientific discoveries and inventions to improve their society and to improve their technology and to improve themselves as well. That's a big thing too. And this is the most interesting material in the novel. And it ties in with the sort of like the wider kind of story. It's the reason you should read the book. So, technology. Oh, I talked about a bit of technology before. Reading and writing. So the narrator is pretty good. He had a tendency to make his characters whine a bit more than I expected, because like I say, I've read this book a few times before, and one thing that I like doing is listening to an audiobook, because it does bring out different meanings and different things, and I hear different things by the performance of the narrator. You know, things that I won't notice if I'm just reading the book myself. But there was a few times when I thought, wait a second, in my book, that person sounded really determined when they said those words, and it's going, yeah, we're going to go out here and do this. Or, yeah, it's really cold out there. It's really hot out there. Let's do this. And that's the way I read it. But then he would say, oh, it's really cold out there. And I'm like, oh, okay, what's going on there? That's just an example. But otherwise, a very good job. I really like the different voices of the different times. He did bring out the different voices of the, like you say, each individual pack has individual pack members. And it was a good job done there by the narrator to sort of bring that idea to life, even though the material is right there in the text that he's reading. Unfortunately, I don't have the information of who the narrator was here. I'll put it in the show notes. I probably won't. The writing is very good, though. It is a bit clunky. Like, when Vinji starts describing technology or the interaction of the times and stuff, not a single foot wrong. It's, you know, it's amazing. Very, very interesting. But then when he writes about humans interacting with other humans, it kind of goes clunk, clunk, clunk. And some stuff does. The pacing is a bit strange, like I say, but I think that's just because of the simplicity of the plot. And he's wanting to do a lot more with the ideas than he is doing with the plot. So sometimes the plot can drag a bit. But otherwise, it's very well written and very well paced. What now? Yeah, theme. So I wrote down this thing here, tell story about seagulls. Seagulls. Because seagulls are interesting birds. No, the reason I wrote this down is because it might be a story that I've told before, but let me just get into this end part of this podcast by telling this story. So I went over to this working holiday at a national park in the UK, in the Lake District in Cumbria, and we went to a place called Egremont, which is a seaside town, and we had fish and chips when we were there, and we were sitting on the seafront, And we're sitting on these benches, and there was these seagulls flying around, and the seagull would come and they'd try and get the chips, you know, the fish and chips. So it's sort of like big chunky potato fries. And so we'd throw them there. And then there was the seagulls would fly overhead. And we worked out that if we had a chip, and as the bird was swooping in, if we threw this big chunky potato fry chip thing high enough, the seagull would sweep in and catch the potato chip, chunky potato fry chip thing out of the air and eat it. And we were really amazed about this. So we were doing this for a while, and lots of birds, a big group of seagulls flying around us, scooping these chips out of the air. But then we thought, well, okay, we don't want to waste too many of these chips, because they were our dinner that evening. So we picked up some stones and threw the stones in the air. But the birds didn't swoop in and get the stones. And we were thought, oh, so they can tell the difference between, you know, these big chunky potato chips and the stones. And that's, of course, you know, you can see them straight away. So we thought, let's do this. So we got the chunky potato chips and put pebbles inside the chips and then threw them up into the air. And no matter what we did, the birds wouldn't come and eat the chips that had the stones in them. So we thought, okay, well, let's do this really, you know, really like scientifically. So we'd sort of actually hide and put a stone in one potato chip and not in the other, like underneath. And then we'd throw one into the air and the other one into the air at about the same time as birds flew in. And they would never go for the one with the stone in the chip. And they would only ever go for the one with the stone out of the chip. And we thought they must be sensing it somehow. And we couldn't work out how the birds caught the chips with no stones in them, and how they, you know, avoided the ones with the stones in them. So it was one of those really weird stories. And then, of course, you know, we finished the chip. We didn't have any chips left to experiment anymore. And that's always stayed with me as, you know, a really interesting little thing about seagulls and the way that they see the world and the way that we see the world. And we think, well, seagulls are dumb, things like that. So that's my story. Now, the truth of the matter is that that story didn't happen to me. What happened? It was in the same holiday, but we're actually sitting around and we were discussing this different stories and things like that. And someone told a joke or told a story. And I said, well, no, if you're telling a story, you should always tell a joke or a funny story in the first person, because if you tell it in the first person, you know, it's more immediate to the people. People can enjoy it and they can picture you doing the thing. It's sort of like, oh, yeah, and I did, like, a friend of mine did this, and a friend of mine was on a plane, and, you know, this happened and this happened. You know, you say, I was on a plane and this happened and this happened. And I thought that was, you know, it was an interesting situation. And this guy, someone else, told the story of the seagulls. And so I said, oh, that's a great story. And I just said it, you know, as a joke. I'm going to tell that story again, but I'm always going to tell it in the first person. I'm going to say that I did that and I discovered this about seagulls. And he's like, oh, that's a really cool idea. And so now I've been telling that story for the last, it was in 2000 when that happened. So for the last 11 years, I've been telling the story of the seagull and the seagulls catching the chips from the fish and chip meal that we're having out of the air and not eating the things. And because I've told that story so many times in the first person, I have more memories of doing that. I mean, it's not even that I have more memories. My memories are completely clear. I remember throwing the chips in the air because I've told the story so many times and I've gone over all the details of when people say, oh, what? Where were you? Oh, I was here in Egremont. The story didn't happen there, but as a group, we went there. So I know what it was like and I know the fish and chip shop that we went to. And all these different details, because I've told the story so many times, are clear in my head to the point that when I'm telling the story, I forget on many levels that it's not a true story. I forget that it didn't actually happen to me. It happened to somebody else. I've just told the story enough that that I now remember it. So now with that week of me going, on this working holiday in the Lake District, of most of the days, I sort of have like this memory. Yeah, we climbed, Scarfell Pike three times or two times. I can't remember when we did these other bits of jobs. And I kind of remember the people I was there with a bit and we, you know, where we stayed and, you know, where we walked and all these different kind of things. I remember some of those, but the clearest memory from that week-long trip away is probably me throwing chips to seagulls, and it didn't happen. It was created by someone else, and then by me repeating it over in my mind, it didn't. Yeah, it's actually really strong, and this happens time and time again with things. You never know which one of your memory is real, and this is like an experiment that I've played on myself over the course of 10 years of telling a story as though it's happened until it is real. And there's other things that I've done in the same way, that I've told a lie so many times that it's become real to me. And I know that I'm telling the lie, and I'm doing it kind of as, these are minor things, you know, it's sort of like stories like this. It's not like important things about me that actually matter at all. It's more small things. But it's sort of like an experiment they can tell. Tell the same story over and over again in the first person until you're not sure if it's really happened or not, until it becomes more clear to you, it becomes a more real memory, a more valuable memory, a more valuable story about your life than things that you know are actually real. And that is something that I've done over many years. And it might have been to do with this, that I actually did that kind of stuff. This novel, which I read, you know, for the first time, probably when I was, you know, probably 13, 14 years ago or something like that. This novel, A Fire Upon the Deep, is about that in many different ways. You know, it's about identity and how much your identity is based on your memories. Right from the very beginning, they're creating this, they find that the humans, they find this archive. It's a library. It's a set of memories. And they use a set of instructions to bring these memories to life and to create some kind of power, to create some the blight in a way. And so they're creating power out of memories. They're creating identity out of memories. The same thing happens with Pham Nguyen. He is brought back to life and he's never sure if his memories are real. His stories are fantastic. He doesn't know if they really happened to him or if they've just been sort of composed by the power called the Old One and put into his head. And then you've got the Scrode Riders, which I didn't go into before, but they're these plants who ride these wheeled robotic things, and they only have long-term memories. So when they're left to their own devices, when they're not plugged into this these computer controlled wheeled vehicles that they roll around on, they only remember sort of like, okay, this season I was there because it was imprinted over many seasons, and then I did this, and seasons later I did that. So they need this sort of robotic computer memory to store short-term memories, and their entire personality is made up of, okay, what is the difference between a short-term memory and a long-term memory? What part of their personalities is influenced by the short-term memories compared to the long-term memories? The same thing happens with the Tynes in the novel too. It's all about, okay, this member has this memory and this other member has this memory, but what if these two members die and are replaced? So I have sort of like memories of memories. So this member of my personality, this member of my identity, told another part of my identity about this story, and now I remember it, but I only remember it secondhand. And this is what, you know, and this is what Pilgrim is doing quite a lot of, and this is what, you know, all these other different members are. And they said, well, you know, a real personality, real memories can only go back maybe a few hundred years. A real memory can't go back, and, you know, and someone says, no, I have memories going back to 600 years. Another one says, the legends about me is that I have memories going back 600 years, but actually, my memories only go back 200 years. And the same thing even happens with the humans, not just Pham, but like the kids on this book as well. Their memories are sort of being almost subsumed by the technology. It's like, well, I remember this, but I need this technology. I needed this sort of this bit of you know, this computer that I can carry around with me. That's where I have all of the useful information. And in the same way that you kind of think, well, you know, these days it's not about being intelligent and knowing facts. It's about using Google and being able to come up with facts. It's to discover facts and knowing where to search for facts. And the actual sort of representation of what makes you intelligent or not is changing as technology is applied to us as humans via Google and via the internet and via having smartphones in our pockets all the time. And that's what's tricky with me, is that, you know, so many people say, oh, we just download this, oh, just look this up. And because I work on cruise ships, and it's very difficult to get a reliable internet connection via satellite communications, and it's expensive and it's very slow, that I can't rely on being connected to the internet all the time to do my work. So again, it's just a different thing that people say, oh, we'll just do this, oh, just do that. It's like, yeah, but I'm traveling all the time. And if there's no internet connection, you know, I was in Turkey last year and I ran up like 140 euros worth of internet bills there, trying to do my job and trying to still communicate with people while I was stuck in Istanbul for a week when the Icelandic ash clouds closed down the European airspace. You know, it's a big thing that suddenly when I'm like, okay, now I'm cut off from technology, now I'm cut off from information, so I need to rely on old-fashioned memories and old-fashioned intelligence. So yeah, it's a weird thing. Me, just like I say, last year I wrote a diary for an entire year, and now I was going back through my tax stuff for the last year, and I'm like, oh, when did I buy this? What's this thing for? What's this receipt for that I need to claim as that I'm self-employed? I'm going to claim again today, and then I could just check back through my diary, and I'm like, oh, that's the kind of thing, you know. So yeah, this novel is it's like that story that I just told about the seagulls, which isn't a real story but has become real to me. This book, A Fire Upon the Deep, is in part about this same kind of thing. What is identity? What is memory? What, you know, and how much of your identity is wrapped up in your memory? And also, can you experiment on yourself? And that's what, you know, that's what these people do. Well, I say people. That's what the Tynes do. That's what Pham does. That's what the Scrode writers do. And that's in a way that what I do as well, by playing an experiment on myself with my own memories. And I think it's a valid thing to do. I mean, I eat left-handed, but only because when I was about 7 or 8 years old, I discovered the secret. I discovered the trick on how to eat left-handed really easily. And so since then, I've been eating left-handed, and now I can't really eat right-handed. I can in a way, but it takes a lot of effort for me to sort of eat right-handed. But eating left-handed is just what I do. And it's a strange thing. Maybe I'll talk about this more in the future, sort of self-experimentation for no reason at all, just to see what happens. And I've been doing it, like I say, all my life when I decided to teach myself to eat left-handed and worked out how to do it and stuck with it. And now, what, 25 years later, 23 years later or something, I'm still eating left-handed. It's a silly thing to do, but that's the kind of thing that I do. So this novel, I'm going to give it 4.5 stars. It's really, really good. It's not perfect. It's certainly up there with the greats of science fiction from the last 20 years or so. I don't think many novels that were written in the early 90s will hold up as well as this novel has done. And I think that's the reason why there's a sequel written, Children in the Sky, which I read the first set of chapters in that, the first hour, 2 hours or so. I say read. I listened to it as an audiobook. And so now I'm going to get back to it, but I've got another 2 books to review before I will get onto the review of that book. So actually, let me just go over to goodreads.com, because there's a few things here. There's a great review here that I read just before I did this. It's by Brian, and he actually lists things. He says, it gives it a 5-star review, and then he says, maybe I'll come off as a bit bipolar by starting a 5-star review with an extensive list of why the book I'm applauding is utter garbage. But hell, I'm game if you are. Let's do this thing. And he does talk about sort of how the plot is simple and the archetypes. I think he missed a bit with the archetypes. He moans about the, you're going to call someone Lord Steel. No. You're not going to, the author doesn't call him Lord Steel, the character calls him Lord Steel. Yeah, and there's a bit different bits. And I do agree with all of his, except the archetypes one, all of his criticisms. But then he also says, just read the book. I'm not going to give you any further idea of what's so great about this book. To do so would be criminal, because Verna Vinge is just so damn good at what he does that talking about the Tynes or the Zones can't do them justice. That's the thing. The review that I've just done doesn't give this book justice. If you think, oh, well, that's a good idea about the Tynes, and that's a good idea about memory, and that's a good idea about the Zones of Thought, what I've talked to you about this book isn't enough for you to get anything out of this book. Really, you need to read the book and get it yourself. And the overall rating of this book by 77 reviews of friends of mine, which I'm guessing are listeners of this SFBRP bookshop, is 8.28 average. So I'm giving it 4.28 average, and I'm giving it 4.5. So that's a very highly rated book by the listeners of this podcast. Read it if you haven't already done so. The next book that I'm going to review is called Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom by Cory Doctorow. It's a short novel. I read it as an ebook on my phone on the flight over here to Hawaii. And then after that, I'll get onto Behemoth by Peter Watts, which is the final book in his Rifters trilogy or quadrilogy, depending on how you read it and how you think it should have been published. I think it's a trilogy, so that's the way I'm going to read it and review it. So, and then after that, I'll probably get onto Children of the Sky or other novels that I'll get to then. So, yeah. that's about it. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. I love your feedback, and I do respond to every single email that I got. And there's even some people, one guy sent me some short stories that he'd written, and I read them on the flight over here. When I have time, I don't mind reading some of these short stories. So thanks a lot for that. And yeah, I do reply to every single email that I get, so keep sending them in. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge on Twitter, or become my friend on Facebook. But Facebook is mainly me talking about my travels and my juggling and different things like that. And yeah, goodreads.com, you can follow me on there, become my friend. Like I say, when I read a book and you've read the book and you've reviewed the book, or I can see what you people think, both in aggregate as listeners to the podcast and also individually. So there's one review here that I liked, which said, Tom rated it 5 stars. He said, puppies are adorable. And I think that's a very good, another one here, Joel rated it 4 stars, and then he does his review in the style of one of the text message, one of the news group posts, actually, because all the news group posts in the book, when they're read out by the audiobook narrator, he reads them like in a computer voice. He goes, crypto 0, syntax 81, as received by GR Server Farm Northwest, language path, stream of consciousness, babble, poorly considered arguments, lolcats, good reads, in jokes, funny only to me, irony, English, from, and this is, I'm reading Joel's start of his review, but in the style of the newsgroup postings that you read in full, including all of the metadata and things like that. Key phrases, mind-bending, galactic scope, smooth world-building, bogs down in the middle, characters are kind of flat, telepathic puppy aliens. You know, you can do that kind of text off message, space is really, really, really big. So, yeah. Like I say, if you are my friend on goodreads.com, I can see what you think about books too, which is good. Goodreads.com, luke.burridge/LukeBurridge. And you can see my blog and keep up with my travels and all my other stuff, my essays that I write and videos that I post out. You can find that on my blog, lukeburridge.com/blog. That's it for today. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.